primitives, survival and reproduction, have fostered in us a core social concern for the health and safety of our children and close relatives. This concern means that, in certain circumstances, evolution might actually push us to sacrifice our own survival for the sake of our children's survival, or even that of close relatives. And the more relatives you could save through your sacrifice, so the theory goes, the more likely you'd be to act. From an evolutionary perspective, it makes perfect sense. Let a single carrier of your genes die, that is you, in order to let your larger gene pool of close relatives and extended family survive. So what happens when you're sick with a deadly and contagious infection? Some researchers believe that the sick primate that is abandoned by its community may actually be partly responsible, wandering away to protect its kin from infection. This phenomenon has been documented in cliff swallows and flower beetles. When they're infected with parasites, members of both species appear to migrate away from their kin. There's also evidence that some species have evolved mechanisms to avoid their brethren when they become infected with a dangerous parasite. Researchers at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia, studied Caribbean spiny lobsters, usually gregarious critters that normally live together in communal dens. The researchers found that when otherwise healthy lobsters become infected with a lethal pathogenic virus, they are shunned by their den mates. The uninfected lobsters pick up and leave. What's really amazing is that the uninfected lobsters make for the underwater highway before the diseased lobster shows any symptoms, which means the behavior is likely to involve some chemical sensor and trigger. Here's where it all comes together as far as this theory is concerned. If certain infections drive organisms away from their own group in order to protect their kin, how will other groups respond when an unknown individual comes wandering over the hill? Xenophobia, which is the formal name for the fear of outsiders, appears to be a nearly universal instinct in human culture. It's possible that xenophobia has its roots in some deeply buried instinct to protect one's own group from outside threats to health and survival, including infectious disease. Of course, if that is the case, understanding its origins will give us another powerful tool in fighting an instinct, if it even is one, that has long outlived its usefulness. Superbugs spread fear far and wide. Rising deadly infections puzzle experts. Bacteria run wild, defying antibiotics. You've seen the headlines. They've probably frightened you. And it's true, just as we've been evolving to survive disease, all the organisms that cause disease have been evolving right along with us. You've seen how parasites have evolved very specialized abilities to navigate seemingly impossible challenges to survival, like traveling from a sheep to a snail to an ant in order to get to another sheep. And small organisms, because they multiply so rapidly and so frequently, sometimes cycling through hundreds of generations in just days, have one big evolutionary advantage over us. They evolve faster. Take Staphylococcus aureus, which doctors call staph for short. Staph is a very common bacteria. It may be living on your skin or in your nose right now. It can cause pimples, and it can cause deadly infections like meningitis and toxic shock syndrome. It's also the bug behind many of those terrifying reports of antibiotic-resistant infections plaguing hospitals, and more recently, professional and college sports teams. When penicillin was accidentally discovered by Alexander Fleming in 1928, it was actually inhibiting the growth of staph. That's what was in the petri dish. 14 years later, when penicillin was first used to treat infections in humans, there were virtually no reports of penicillin-resistant staph. But just 8 years later, in 1950, 40% of all staph infections were penicillin-resistant. By 1960, that number had climbed to 80%. Treatment switched to a specialized relative of penicillin called methicillin, which was introduced in 1959. And 2 years later, the first incident of methicillin-resistant staph, known as MRSA, was reported. MRSA is now firmly entrenched in hospitals, and treatment has moved to a different class of antibiotics, usually with one called vancomycin. The first case of VRSA, yep, vancomycin-resistant staph, was reported in 1996 in Japan. All of this sounds frightening, as if we're in an arms race where the other side has vastly superior technology. But that's not the whole story. They're faster, but we're smarter. We can think about how evolution works and try to use that to our advantage. They can't think at all. Now remember that the biological imperatives driving bacteria are survival and reproduction, just like the biological imperatives that drive everything else. So what if we made it easier for a given type of bacteria to survive in a healthy human than to survive in a sick human? Wouldn't that create evolutionary pressure against behavior that harms us? That's what Paul Ewald thinks. Paul Ewald is one of the pioneers of evolutionary biology, especially the evolution of infectious diseases and how pathogens select for or against traits that harm their hosts. The degree to which an organism destroys its host is called virulence. The range of virulence found in pathogens that infect humans is enormous, from all but harmless, pinworms, to unpleasant but hardly dangerous, the common cold, to rapidly, horribly fatal, Ebola. So why does one microbe evolve toward massive virulence while another is content to leave you up and running? Ewald believes the key factor that determines virulence is how a given parasite gets from host to host. When you remember that every infectious agent has the same goal, to survive and reproduce by infecting new hosts, that starts to make a lot of sense. Let's look at the three basic ways a microbe moves from one host to another. Close proximity that allows for transmission through the air or physical contact. Diseases transmitted this way include the common colds and sexually transmitted diseases, STDs. Hitching a ride on an intermediate organism, usually a mosquito, fly, or flea. This category includes malaria, African sleeping sickness, and typhus. Traveling through contaminated food or water. Cholera, typhoid fever, and hepatitis A are all transmitted this way. Now let's think about what that means in terms of virulence. According to Ewald, diseases in the first category face evolutionary pressure against virulence. These microbes rely on their hosts to carry them around and introduce them to new hosts. That means they need their hosts to be relatively healthy, certainly healthy enough to be mobile. That's why you can almost always get up and go to work when you've got a cold, even if you're miserable the whole time. The cold virus leaves you well enough to get on the subway and go to work, sneezing and coughing all the way. Ewald believes the cold virus has hit the evolutionary jackpot. It's evolved to a level of virulence that guarantees our mobility and its survival. In fact, he believes it may never evolve to kill or seriously incapacitate us. On the other hand, when an infectious agent doesn't need its host to get around, things can really heat up. As we mentioned, malaria has evolved to incapacitate us. It doesn't need our help to meet new hosts. Instead, it wants us vulnerable to attack by its blood-sucking buddies, mosquitoes. In fact, there is an evolutionary advantage for the malaria parasite to push its hosts toward the brink of death. The more parasites swarming through our blood, the more parasites the mosquito is likely to ingest. The more parasites the mosquito ingests, the more likely it will cause an infection when it bites someone else. Cholera is similar. It doesn't need us moving around to find new hosts, so there's no reason for the bacteria to select against virulence. It spreads easily through unprotected water supplies when soiled clothes or bed linens are washed in rivers, ponds, and lakes, or through sewage runoff. And again, cholera actually has an advantage in evolving toward virulence. As the bacteria reproduces ruthlessly, causing more and more diarrhea, the infected person may excrete as many as a billion copies of the organism, increasing the likelihood that some bacteria finds its way to a new host. The bottom line is this. If an infectious agent has allies, like mosquitoes, or good delivery systems, such as an unprotected water supply, peaceful coexistence with its host becomes a lot less important. In those cases, evolution is likely to favor versions of the parasite that best exploit its host's resources, allowing the parasite to multiply as much as possible, all of which spells bad news for the host. But not necessarily bad news for humanity. Ewald believes that we can use this understanding to influence the evolution of parasites away from virulence. The basic theory is this: shut down the modes of transmission that don't require human participation, and suddenly all the evolutionary pressure is directed at allowing the human host to get up and get out. Let's look at how this theory would apply to a cholera outbreak. According to Ewald's theory, the virulence of a cholera outbreak in a given population should be directly related to the quality and safety of that population's water supply. If sewage flows easily into rivers that people wash in or drink from, then the cholera strain would evolve toward virulence. It can multiply freely, essentially using up its hosts, relying on its access to the water supply for transmission. But if the water supply is well protected, the organism should evolve away from virulence. The longer it remains in a more mobile host, the better its chance of transmission. A series of cholera outbreaks that began in Peru in 1991 and spread across South and Central America over the next few years provide compelling evidence that Ewald is onto something. The water supply systems from country to country ranged from relatively advanced to seriously rudimentary. Sure enough, when the bacteria invaded nations with poorly protected water supplies, such as Ecuador, the virus became more harmful as it spread. But in countries with safe water supplies, such as Chile, the bacteria evolved downward in virulence and killed fewer people. The implications of this are huge. Instead of challenging bacteria to become stronger and more dangerous through an antibiotic arms race, we could essentially challenge them to get along with us. Think about the application of this theory just in terms of waterborne diseases like cholera. If we clean up water supplies, it will certainly mean fewer people will get infected, because fewer people will consume contaminated water. But if Ewald is right, every dollar spent on protecting water supplies, and thus controlling the transmission channel of the disease, will also steer the evolution of the disease itself toward a less harmful incarnation. As Ewald said, we should be taking control of the evolution of those disease organisms, favoring those mild strains, and thereby essentially domesticating those disease organisms, making them into mild versions of what was there before. With a mild version, most people won't even know they're infected. It'll be almost like those people having a free, live vaccine. If every malaria patient were covered in mosquito netting or stayed indoors, we might push P. falciparum, the malaria-causing protozoa, in a similar direction. If mosquitoes don't have access to bedridden malaria patients, the microbe would be under evolutionary pressure to evolve in a way that allowed the infected person to remain mobile, increasing the opportunity for it to spread. Of course, Ewald knows that his theory isn't always applicable. Some parasites complicate the picture because they are capable of survival outside a host for a very long time. A pathogen that can lie in wait for years until a potential host happens upon it isn't very reliant on transmission pressure. Anthrax is one of these patient predators. The deadly bacteria can exist outside a host for more than 10 years in some situations. In these cases, it's hard to affect virulence by reducing the pathogen's transmission channels because its ability to survive outside a host makes it less concerned with transmission from an evolutionary perspective. We already know that humans can affect the evolution of bacteria. The evolution of all those antibiotic-resistant strains of staph is conclusive proof of that. But Ewald's theory takes the notion that bacterial evolution gives bacteria an advantage over us and turns it on its head. Not by getting involved in some kind of arms race in which we're using one antibiotic weapon against the organism, and the organism evolves a defensive weapon against that antibiotic, and then we have to shift to another, and so on indefinitely. Instead, we have a sense of where we want evolution to end, and we adjust the environment so that the organism freely evolves to that endpoint, which is in its interest and also in our interest. By understanding how the organisms that cause infectious disease have evolved among us, next to us, and inside us, affecting their evolution even as they affect ours, we gain new insight into how those diseases influence us and into how they can be controlled for our benefit. Already, that understanding is giving us the opportunity to interrupt the transmission channel of horrible afflictions like the guinea worm. And it suggests powerful ways to change the course of diseases, like cholera and malaria, that have plagued mankind for longer than there has been a history to record it. When it comes down to it, everything that's alive today wants to do two things: survive and reproduce. The guinea worm wants to. The malaria protozoa wants to. The cholera bacteria wants to. And so, of course, do we. The difference, our big advantage, comes down to one thing. We know it. Chapter 6. Jump into the Gene Pool. Edward Jenner was just a country doctor in Gloucestershire, England, at the end of the 18th century, when he noticed a surprising pattern. Milkmaids who caught cowpox, that's what used to happen when you spent a lot of time with cows, a very mild infection in humans, seemed to be resistant to smallpox, a very deadly infection in humans. So Jenner wondered whether he could duplicate the effect intentionally. He scraped a cowpox sore on an infected milkmaid and purposefully infected several teenage boys. Sure enough, his hunch was correct. The cowpox infection resulted in protection from smallpox. And Edward Jenner, not just a simple country doctor after all, had the first vaccine on his hands. The word vaccine actually comes from the Latin word for cow, vacca. Today, we know a lot more about how vaccination works. It begins with a relatively harmless version of the virus we want to vaccinate against. Harmless because weakened or killed and broken up into pieces. Or, like cowpox, a relative close enough to the harmful virus that our bodies will recognize it, but distant enough that it does not cause serious harm. By introducing the harmless virus to our bodies, we stimulate our immune systems to produce antibodies specifically tailored to defend against that virus. Then, if we are exposed to the harmful version, our bodies are prepared to defend themselves immediately. Cowpox, for example, causes only a very mild infection in people. But its structure is so close to that of smallpox that the antibodies our immune systems produce to fight cowpox will also work against smallpox. Without having the right-fitting preformed antibodies, viral attackers can make us sick before our immune system has time to generate the antibodies we need to fight back. Now here's where it really gets interesting. There's a massive number of potential microbial attackers out there, and our bodies produce a specific antibody to fight back against each and every one. For a long time, scientists couldn't understand how that worked. There just didn't seem to be enough active genes in humans to direct the production of all these antibodies. Of course, they didn't know that genes could change. Every human being starts off with exactly the same number of cells as the simplest form of bacteria, one. That single cell, or zygote, is the product of the union of two other cells, a sperm cell supplied by the father and an egg cell supplied by the mother, that combine to produce a human in progress. Millions of years of evolutionary pressure, response, adaptation, and selection come together in that first cell. It contains every single genetic instruction to manufacture the proteins used to build a human being. All of those instructions are carried in about 3 billion pairs of nucleotides. Those pairs of nucleotides are called DNA base pairs, of which there are assumed to be less than 30,000 genes. The genes themselves are organized among 23 pairs of chromosomes, for a total of 46. One set of 23 chromosomes comes from the mother, and one comes from the father. Every pair, except for the 23rd, the sex chromosome, is a matched pair. In other words, each chromosome carries the same type of instructions, although they will vary greatly in how they instruct your body to carry out those instructions. For example, let's just say that specific chromosomes contain instructions for whether or not you'll have hair on your fingers. The instructions may code for hairy fingers in the chromosomes that come from your father, while coding for hairless fingers in the chromosomes that come from your mother. In that case, you will have hair on your fingers. The trait for hairy fingers is dominant, while the trait for hairless fingers is recessive. That means one copy of the fictitious gene for hairy fingers is enough to ensure that you exhibit that trait. You need two copies of the gene for hairless fingers, one from your mother and one from your father, in order to have hairless fingers yourself. Usually, with one very important exception, every cell in your body contains the same DNA. Two complete sets of chromosomes with all the genes containing all the instructions you need to build every type of protein and every type of cell. The exception is germ cells, the cells that combine to produce offspring. Sperm and eggs each contain only one set of 23 chromosomes. When they unite to form a zygote, the resulting cell has a full complement of 46 chromosomes, two sets of 23 each. But from the moment you're a sparkle in daddy's eye and a single-celled zygote on the way to implanting in mommy's uterus, every other cell includes your complete blueprint. Your toenails have the code to build brain cells, and your brain cells have the code for toenails, and fingernails, and blood cells, and just about everything else in your body. But what's even more interesting is that less than 3% of your DNA contains instructions for building cells. The vast majority of your DNA, 97% of it, isn't active in building anything. Think about that. If you took the DNA from any cell in your body and laid it end to end, it would reach the top of Shaquille O'Neal's head, but the DNA that actively codes for building your body wouldn't even reach his ankle. Scientists initially called all this additional genetic material junk DNA. They originally assumed that if it didn't code for cellular production, it was essentially parasitic, more or less lounging in the gene pool for millions of years without making any contribution to its upkeep. In other words, they thought this DNA did nothing for us at all. They imagined it was just hitching a ride through life, not hurting us, not helping us, just helping itself. A series of new research is beginning to demonstrate that the previous assumption that so-called junk DNA is junk was bunk. It turns out that the massive volume of genetic information in this portion of our genome may play a critical role in evolution. As its importance has been reevaluated, the respect it gets from the scientific community has begun to change. The standard term for this genetic material has even been upgraded from junk DNA to non-coding DNA, which means it isn't directly responsible for making proteins. Perhaps the biggest surprise is where much of this non-coding DNA comes from. You know that idea of a blissful future when bacteria, viruses, and humans live together in happy, healthy coexistence? What if I told you it's already sort of happening? Almost every human cell contains microscopic workhorses called mitochondria that function as dedicated power plants, producing the energy to run cells. Most scientists now believe that mitochondria were once independent parasitic bacteria that evolved a mutually beneficial relationship with some of our pre-mammal evolutionary predecessors. Not only do these likely former bacteria live in almost all your cells, they even have their own inheritable DNA, called mitochondrial DNA, or mtDNA. Former bacteria aren't the only microbes we've married. Researchers now believe that as much as a third of your DNA is from viruses. In other words, our evolution hasn't only been shaped by adaptation to viruses and bacteria, it's probably been shaped by integration of viruses and bacteria. Until recently, the scientific community all but universally agreed that genetic changes were the product of accidental mutations, caused by errors that were only random and always rare. Here's how those mutations happen. When cells are produced, DNA is copied from the parent cell to the daughter cell. This process usually produces accurate copies. But errors in the production of the long string of information that composes DNA do occur. In order to protect an organism against these errors, the transcription process is complemented by a proofreading system. Those proofreaders are so good that if we cloned them for publishers, they'd put copy editors out of business. Their error rate is phenomenally low, just one out-of-place nucleotide in every billion copies. When an error does get through, that new combination of DNA sequences, however slight, is a mutation. Mutations also occur when organisms are exposed to radiation or powerful chemicals, like those found in cigarette smoke and other carcinogens. When that happens, it can also rearrange DNA. Before genetic engineering enabled us to modify food on a molecular level, plant breeders who wanted to create more efficient crops, hardier or more fruit-bearing, for example, would irradiate seeds by blasting them with a ray gun that could have come straight out of Star Trek, and then hope for the best. Most of the time, seeds couldn't even sprout after being irradiated. But every once in a while, this heavy-handed genetic manipulation produced a beneficial trait. Even the sun can cause mutation, not just by frying your skin and causing skin cancer, but on a global scale. Every 11 years, sunspot activity peaks, and increased solar radiation explodes from the sun. Much of that energy is deflected by the Earth's gigantic magnetic field, but some of it can leak through and play havoc. In March 1989, a peak in sunspot activity led to a huge power surge that left more than 6 million people without power in parts of the northeastern United States and Canada. The sun spewed out so much energy that satellites were knocked out of orbit. Garage doors began to open and close in California, and millions of people were treated to a version of the northern lights in places as far south as Cuba. That may not be all the havoc these sunspot peaks cause. There's a curious correlation between these sunspot peaks and flu epidemics. In the 20th century, 6 of the 9 sunspot peaks occurred in tandem with massive flu outbreaks. In fact, the worst outbreaks of the century, killing millions in 1918 and 1919, followed a sunspot peak in 1917. This might just be coincidence, of course. Or it might not. Outbreaks and pandemics are thought to be caused by antigenic drift, when a mutation occurs in the DNA of a virus, or antigenic shift, when a virus acquires new genes from a related strain. When the antigenic drift or shift in a virus is significant enough, our bodies don't recognize it and have no antibodies to fight it. And that spells trouble. It's like a criminal on the run taking on a whole new identity so his pursuers can't recognize him. What causes antigenic drift? Mutations, which can be caused by radiation, which is what the sun spews forth in significantly greater than normal amounts every 11 years. The potential for evolution begins when a mutation occurs during the reproductive process of a given organism. In most cases, that mutation will have a harmful effect or no effect at all. Rarely, a random mutation will confer an advantage on its carrier, giving it a better chance to survive, thrive, and reproduce. In those cases, natural selection comes into play. The mutation spreads throughout the population through successive generations, and you have evolution. Adaptations that confer truly significant benefit to a species will eventually spread across an entire species, as when a strain of the flu virus acquires the new characteristic to go pandemic. But organisms, so the collective wisdom went, only happen upon helpful mutations by chance. Remember, of course, that one species' advantage may be another species' disadvantage. An adaptation that allows a bacterium that harms humans to resist antibiotics is an advantage for the bacteria. For us, not so much. According to this way of thinking, the genome of every creature, great and small, lacks any ability to react intentionally on a genetic level to environmental changes that threaten its ability to survive and reproduce. It has to depend on luck to find a helpful mutation, or so the thinking goes. When the common strep infection evolves a trait that gives it antibiotic resistance, it's all luck. When humans evolved to cope with the rapid onset of the Younger Dryas, it was all luck. To be clear, scientists thought natural selection was influenced by the environment, but mutation never was. Mutation was an accident, natural selection occurred when the accident was helpful. The problem with this theory is that it takes the evolution out of evolution. After all, what would be a more helpful mutation than one that allowed the genome to react to environmental changes and pass on helpful adaptations to successive generations? Surely evolution would favor a mutation that helped an organism to discover adaptations that would help it survive. Saying otherwise is like saying that the only part of life not subject to evolutionary pressure is evolution itself. The only random changes theory looks even weaker in light of recent work to map the human genome. Geneticists originally believed that every single gene had a single purpose: a gene for eye color, a gene for a widow's peak, a gene for attached earlobes. When genes went wrong, you ended up with a gene for cystic fibrosis, a gene for hemochromatosis, a gene for favism. That theory suggested the existence of more than 100,000 genes. But today, because of all the work that's gone into genome mapping, the total number of genes is thought to be about 25,000. Suddenly, it's clear that genes don't have discrete jobs at all. There wouldn't be nearly enough genes to produce all the proteins necessary for human life if each gene had only one job. Instead, single genes have the capacity to produce many, many different proteins through a complex process of copying, cutting, and combining instructions. In fact, like a casino dealer who never stops, genes can shuffle and reshuffle endlessly to produce a huge array of proteins. There's one gene in a type of fruit fly that can produce almost 40,000 different proteins. All this shuffling isn't restricted to single genes either. The genetic dealer can borrow cards from other decks, combining parts of one gene with another. On a genomic level, that's where most of the complexity lies, and it's where the genetic work of making us human really happens. We may have the same genes as many other organisms, but it's what we do with them that counts. Of course, the idea that our genome can change has suddenly blurred the lines of what precisely a gene actually is. Yet from an efficiency perspective, it makes a lot of sense for genes to be resourceful and to maximally utilize existing genetic parts. It's similar to the Japanese managerial system Kaizen, made famous in the 1980s. According to Kaizen, many working decisions are made on the factory floor and then communicated up to management. It's much more efficient to make a minor modification to an assembly line than to redesign the whole line. On top of that, there are all kinds of redundancies built into the system. Scientists discovered this when they isolated specific genes related to specific functions in some organisms and removed those genes. They were shocked when these knockout, KO experiments often did nothing at all. Removing the gene in question simply had no effect. Other genes essentially stepped up and filled in for their KO'd colleague. Instead of imagining genes as a set of discrete instructions, scientists have begun to conceive of them as an intricate network of information with an overall regulatory structure that can react to change. Like a foreman at a construction site who directs a particularly fast welder to pick up the slack when his buddy doesn't show up for work, the genome system can react to a knocked-out gene and get a body built just the same. Except the foreman isn't only a particular gene giving orders. Rather, the whole system is interconnected and automatically covers for its parts. You can see how these discoveries make it even harder to imagine how evolution relied only on random little changes in the code of individual genes to find the myriad adaptations that have allowed every living thing on Earth to survive. If removing whole genes often has no effect on a creature, how could such minor changes be the only chance for the evolution of a new species, or even the successful adaptation of an existing one? They probably can't. Jean-Baptiste Lamarck was a French thinker and student of nature who popularized some of the current thinking about evolution and heredity in 1809 with the publication of his book, Zoological Philosophy. In popular accounts of the history of evolutionary theory, Lamarck is built up into a somewhat foolish scientist who advances a series of wrong-headed theories about evolution and eventually loses an intellectual war with Charles Darwin. According to the popular story, Lamarck was the chief proponent of a theory of inherited, acquired traits. The essence of that theory is the idea that traits acquired by a parent during his or her lifetime could then be passed on to his or her offspring. It suggested, for example, that Lamarck believed that giraffes' long necks were the result of each generation's straining its neck ever farther to reach leaves on higher branches, or that a blacksmith's son would be born with stronger arms because his father developed those muscles hammering against his anvil. According to the myth about Lamarck, Darwin came along and proved Lamarck all wrong, debunking the notion that traits acquired in the lifetime of a parent could be passed to its offspring. In fact, very little of this story is true. The truth is, Lamarck was more of a philosopher than a scientist, and his book was more of a layman's description of current evolutionary thinking designed for a general audience than a treatise of scientific analysis. Lamarck did promote the concept of inherited acquired traits, but he also promoted the concept of evolution, and he didn't come up with either one, nor did he pretend to. At the time, the notion of inherited acquired characteristics was widely held, including by Darwin. Darwin even praised Lamarck in The Origin of the Species for helping to popularize the idea of evolution. Unfortunately for him, poor Jean-Baptiste became the victim of a schoolbook version of the theory he didn't develop. Somewhere along the line, a science writer, whose name is lost to history, acquired the notion that Lamarck was responsible for the idea of inherited acquired traits, and generations of successive science writers have inherited that idea and passed it on. In other words, somebody blamed the theory on Lamarck, and lots of other people have repeated it right up to today. Textbooks still tell of silly-sounding Lamarckian researchers attempting to prove their theories by cutting off the tails of generation after generation of mice, waiting in vain for a generation to be born without tails. Here's the funny thing. The theory of inherited acquired traits that's responsible for Lamarck's general disregard? It isn't exactly right, but it may not be exactly wrong. Let's leave the story of the fellow guilty of nothing more than repeating the widely accepted theories of his time and turn to a woman who offered theories widely dismissed in hers. Barbara McClintock was the Emily Dickinson of genetics, a brilliant, influential, revolutionary thinker who was ignored by her peers for most of her life. She received her Ph.D. in 1927 when she was 25 years old. For the next 50 years, she pursued her singular ideas with little need for, and little receipt of, recognition or encouragement. Most of her research focused on the genetics of corn, its DNA, its mutation, and its evolution. As I said, just about every geneticist in the 20th century believed that genetic mutations were random, rare, and relatively small. But in the 1950s, McClintock produced evidence that in certain circumstances, parts of the genome actively triggered much larger changes. This wasn't evidence of minor mutations, in which a slight change in one gene on one chromosome slipped through the proofreading system. This was evidence of seismic changes on the genetic scale. Especially when the plants were stressed, McClintock discovered whole sequences of DNA moving from one place to another, even inserting themselves into active genes. When these genes cut and pasted themselves from one place in the corn's DNA to another, they actually affected nearby genes. By changing the sequence of DNA, they sometimes turned genes on and sometimes turned them off. What's more, McClintock found that these wandering genes weren't behaving completely randomly. There was a method to their meandering. First of all, they relocated to certain parts of the genome more often than to other parts. Second, these active mutations appear to be triggered by outside influences, by changes in the environment that threaten the survival of the corn, like extreme heat or drought. In short, the corn plant seemed to be engaged in some sort of intentional mutation, neither random nor rare. Today, the genetic nomads McClintock discovered are called jumping genes, and they have reshaped our understanding of mutation and evolution. But widespread acceptance of her thinking was a long time coming. When she first presented her ideas in 1951 at the famed Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on Long Island, where she worked, she might as well have been jumping up and down for all the respect she received. Instead of being toasted, she was greeted with that tired brew of skepticism and scorn that all too often welcomes fresh thinking of any kind. Over the next 30 years, as molecular biology and genetics evolved themselves, others slowly began to appreciate McClintock's work. Jumping genes were found in other genomes beyond corn. Our understanding of mutation began to shift. In 1983, at the age of 81, Barbara McClintock received a Nobel Prize. With characteristic focus, she continued to look past current thinking and, in her acceptance speech, imagined a future when attention undoubtedly will be centered on the genome, with greater appreciation of its significance as a highly sensitive organ of the cell that monitors genomic activities and corrects common errors, senses unusual and unexpected events, and responds to them, often by restructuring the genome. McClintock's discovery of the jumping gene opened the door to the possibility of much more robust mutations than the random and rare theory allowed. This in turn suggested that evolution itself could be faster and more sudden than ever before imagined. Instead of a minor spelling error in one word in one verse of the DNA songbook, whole melody lines could insert themselves all over the genome. Like a good hip-hop artist, the genome has the ability to sample itself, creating different but similar riffs. And a sturdy networked genome, the emerging notion of a genome that could cope with problems like inactive genes being knocked out, could often survive, and sometimes benefit, from such improvisation. Scientists are still only beginning to understand how jumping genes, or transposons, as they're known, actually work. Sometimes they copy and paste, copying themselves and then inserting the new material elsewhere in the genome while remaining in their original location. Other times they cut and paste, removing themselves from their starting place and inserting themselves somewhere else. Sometimes the new genetic element stays in place, and sometimes it's removed by the proofreading system or suppressed by other methods. This much is clear. Sometimes these transposable genetic elements remain in an active gene once they've inserted themselves, and they make a difference. A recent study demonstrated just how much difference a jumping gene can make under the right conditions. A jumping gene in one line of fruit flies turned the line into semi-superhero fruit flies. Researchers aptly named the fly Methuselah, with the ability to resist starvation and withstand high temperature, as well as a life expectancy that was 35% longer than usual. The key question for scientists to unravel now is why these transposons get the urge to jump. McClintock believed that the jumps are a genomic response to internal or environmental stress that cells can't handle under their existing setup. Essentially, a challenge to survival triggers the organism to throw the mutation dice, hoping it will land on a change that will help. That's what she thought was going on with the corn plant she was studying. Too much heat or too little water triggered the corn to gamble its survival on finding a mutation that could help it survive. When that happens, the proofreading mechanism is suppressed and mutations are allowed to blossom. Then natural selection kicks in to select the adaptive mutations over the maladaptive mutations in future generations. And presto, evolution. McClintock not only observed that jumping genes were jumpiest during times of stress, she also noted that they tended to jump to certain genes more than others. She believed This was intentional. If the jumps were random, they would land with similar frequency across the genome. Instead, she believed the genome directed its jumpers toward those places in the genome where mutations were most likely to have a beneficial effect. In other words, the dice were loaded for the corn's benefit, even if just a little bit. The extent to which these jumping genes have fascinated scientists is evident in the names they've been given. Gypsy, Mtanga, Swahili for wanderer, Castaway, Evil Knievel, and Mariner. Those aren't genes from any particular species, and we're still learning about their various functions. But when most genes are given sexy names like APOE4, it's clear that many scientists are fans of these genes and entranced by what they can teach us. There's even one called Jordan, named by Washington University researchers after Michael Jordan's amazing leaping ability. Today, scientists continue to follow McClintock's lead away from the notion that the genome is a rigid set of plans, and that mutation, and thus evolution, is only triggered by rare and random errors. As Dr. Gregory Demigian of the University of Texas writes, "The genome has long been thought of as an archival blueprint of life, a relatively permanent record. Mobile genetic elements, such as McClintock's jumping genes, are replacing that view with one of an ephemeral environment, undergoing continuous remodeling. In other words, the genome likes to move the furniture around." A series of studies in the 1980s and 1990s provided additional insight into the genome's ability to gamble on mutation. The first was documented in an incendiary 1987 report by Harvard researcher John Cairns in the journal Nature that used language hearkening back to the theory of inherited acquired traits, the theory wrongly assigned to Lamarck. Cairns conducted studies with Escherichia coli, a bacteria known to its friends and human hosts as E. coli. And despite the fearful reputation it's earned because bad strains sometimes turn up in the wrong place, killing people, E. coli does far more good than harm. It's one of the essential bacteria toiling away in your digestive system right now that we discussed earlier. E. coli is a digestive workhorse in humans and can come in many different flavors or variants, one of which can't naturally digest lactose, a sugar derived from milk. Nothing is a bigger threat or evolutionary pressure to bacteria than starvation. So Cairns deprived milk-shunning E. coli of any food except lactose. Much more rapidly than chance should have allowed, bacteria developed mutations that allowed them to lose their lactose intolerance. Just as McClintock maintained about her corn plants, Cairns also reported that bacteria appeared to target specific areas of their genome, areas where mutations were most likely to be advantageous. Cairns concluded that the bacteria were choosing which mutations to go after and then passing on their acquired ability to digest lactose to successive generations of bacteria. In a statement that amounted to evolutionary heresy, he wrote that E. coli can choose which mutation they should produce and may have a mechanism for the inheritance of acquired characteristics. He straight out raised the possibility of inherited acquired traits. He basically used those words. It was like shouting, "Go Sox!" at Yankee Stadium during the ninth inning of the seventh game of the playoffs with Boston leading by a run. Since then, researchers have plunged into their petri dishes in attempts to prove, disprove, or just explain Cairns' work. A year after Cairns' report came out, Barry Hall, a scientist at the University of Rochester, suggested that the bacteria's ability to happen upon a lactose processing adaptation rapidly was caused by a massive increase in the mutation rate. Hall called this hypermutation, sort of like mutation on steroids. And according to him, it helped the bacteria to produce the mutations they needed to survive about 100 million times faster than the mutations otherwise would have been produced. In 1997, other studies added credibility to the hypermutation theory. A significant increase in mutation rates was noticed when E. coli were starved of their normal diet, but surrounded by lactose. the studies reported an uptick in mutation across the bacterial genome. Many different mutations, not just the targeted mutations designed to overcome lactose intolerance that Cairns observed. But even though these researchers reported a greater range of mutation than Cairns documented, the overall increase in mutation also suggests that the genome has the ability to order mutations on demand when the regular genetic programming just isn't good enough. And French researchers led by Ivan Matic of the Institut National de la Santé et de la Recherche Médicale studied hundreds of bacteria from all over the world and found that they also went into hyperdrive, mutationally speaking, when put under stress. Although the evidence is mounting, the case of hypermutation is definitely still pending. Crazy corn, a gene named after an NBA player, and lactose-intolerant bacteria are all well and good, but you're probably wondering what all this has to do with us. Before we dive into the human gene pool, let's review a few rules, starting with a generally accepted genetic principle called the Weismann barrier. August Weismann was a 19th century biologist who delivered the germ plasma theory, which divides the body's cells into two groups, germ cells and somatic cells. Germ cells are cells that contain information that is passed on to your children. Eggs and sperm are the ultimate germ cells. Every other cell in your body is a somatic cell. Red blood cells, white blood cells, skin cells, hair cells are all somatic cells. The Weismann barrier stands between germ cells and somatic cells. The theory maintains that information in somatic cells is never passed on to germ cells. So a mutation that occurs on the somatic side of the barrier, say, in a red blood cell, can't move over to the germ side, and thus will never be passed on to your children. That doesn't mean a mutation in the germ line can't affect somatic cells in your offspring. Remember that all of the instructions to build and maintain your body originated in the germline of your parents. So a mutation in your germline that changes the instructions for hair color would affect the hair color of your children. The Weismann barrier is an important organizing principle in genetic research, but some research suggests that it isn't as impenetrable as we once thought. Some retroviruses or viruses, which we'll discuss in more detail shortly, may be able to penetrate the Weismann barrier and carry DNA from somatic cells to germ cells. If so, that would theoretically open the door to the idea that acquired adaptations could be passed on to future generations. Which would mean that Lamarck, discredited for spreading one of many ideas that wasn't his own, got a really raw deal. From an evolutionary perspective, we're mostly familiar with germline mutations, mutations that result in a different gene in egg or sperm that produce a new trait in the offspring. And as you know, when a new trait increases the offspring's ability to survive or reproduce, it's more likely to spread throughout the population as the first generation of offspring with the new trait passes it on to the next. When a new trait inhibits survival or reproduction, it will ultimately disappear, as those who carry it are less likely to survive. But mutations occur outside the germline all the time. Cancer, of course, is one of the most common, and one of the most frightening examples. At its most basic, cancer is uncontrolled cell growth caused by a mutation in the gene that is supposed to control the growth of the cancerous cells. Some cancers are at least partially hereditary. Mutations in the BRCA1 or BRCA2 genes significantly increase the risk of breast cancer, for example, and those mutations can be passed from one generation to another. Other cancers can be caused by mutations that are caused by external triggers, like smoking or exposure to radiation. It's true that most mutations, especially somatic mutations, like the mutations in lung cells that can be caused by smoking, don't work out so well. That makes sense. Biological organisms, especially humans, are pretty complicated. But mutation, by definition, isn't necessarily bad. It's just different. And that, it turns out, may be the key to how jumping genes help humans in two very important ways. Jumping genes are very active in the early stages of brain development, inserting genetic material all over the developing brain, almost helter-skelter, as a normal part of brain development. Every time one of those jumpers inserts or changes genetic material in brain cells, it's technically a mutation. And all of that genetic jumping around may have a very important purpose. It may help to create the variety and individuality that make every brain unique. This developmental frenzy of genetic copy and paste only happens in the brain, because that's where we benefit from individuality. But as the lead author of the study that discovered this phenomenon, Professor Fred Gage, said, "You wouldn't want that added element of individuality in your heart." The neural network in your brain isn't the only complex system that welcomes diversity. Your immune system does too. In fact, your immune system employs what has got to be the most diverse workforce in history. We wouldn't have survived long as a species without it. In order to fight the huge array of potential microbial invaders that threaten us, the human immune system employs more than a million different antibodies, specialized proteins that target specific invaders. The mechanism through which we produce all those different proteins isn't completely understood, especially because we don't have nearly enough genes to explain it. Remember, there are only about 25,000 active coding genes, and we're talking about the possibility of more than a million different antibodies. But new research, led by scientists from Johns Hopkins, has linked the immune system's antibody production mechanism to the behavior of jumping genes. B cells are the basic building blocks for antibodies. When we